I will now pass it over to Jennifer Hanna, who will open today's call.
Thank you, Zoe. And good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining today. I am Jennifer Hanna, Deputy Director of ASPR's National Healthcare Preparedness Programs Branch, and it's my pleasure to be with you today to connect on a variety of disaster response topics. Before I go over the agenda for today's call, I'd like to provide some updates regarding the Cooperative Agreement Accountability and Management Platform, or CAMP. First, I want to thank you for submitting your mid-year reports on time. Our data team is reviewing and analyzing the data submissions. In preparation for opening of the end of year report on June 1st, please ensure that your list of subrecipients in CAMP is accurate. You can find it by navigating to the contacts page and choosing View All from the drop-down menu on the left-hand corner. The list of subrecipients and email contacts needs to be up to date for end of year reporting. Please update and validate this information by May 31st. Please reach out to your assigned project officer or Kate Gorbach at kategorbach@deloitte.com if you need further assistance. Also, please join the community collaboration page on CAMP. You can get there by going from the navigation bar to collaboration to community collaboration. Move your settings to weekly digest or every post so that you get email updates when there are announcements. We also highly recommend joining the group for your region. You can get there by going from the navigation bar to collaboration to groups or region-specific announcements. And we will ensure that this information is included in the webinar follow-up email with the recording link and slides from today's webinar. Next slide. During today's call, Dr. Till Jolly will first share information regarding the National Emergency Telecritical Care Network, or NETSN. Next, Sonia Bell from Emory University Hospital will demonstrate the National Emerging Special Pathogens Training and Education Center, or NETEC's new Guide My PPE app. Then our senior advisor, Matthew Watson, will present on the guidelines for regional healthcare emergency preparedness and response systems. Finally, we will have some time at the end for questions from the audience. I will now pass it over to Dr. Till Jolly.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me in front of this group, and we'll certainly have some time for questions. I'm Till Jolly. I'm an emergency physician. I've been supporting ASPR as senior consultant for emergency care and working very closely with Jennifer and others on the team on a number of issues related to telemedicine and disaster preparedness. So actually before COVID started, but I'm gonna talk specifically about a program that we're in partnership with the military, and I'll go into how that works in a second, called NETSN, the National Emergency Telecritical Care Network. Next slide, please. So as you see here from the logos, NETSN is a collaboration. A key logo down at the bottom is TATRIC, the purple one. The Telemedicine Advanced Technology Research Center of the Department of Defense, which is really the initial incubator of NETSN. Also key to this was Society of Critical Care Medicine, which is the largest society of intensivists and has supplied expertise to TATRIC in the development. And ASPR is obviously now a major player in this, and I'll sort of go into what that means in a second. Next slide, please. So all of you have spent, as I have, lots of times in hospitals over the years. And you know, I'm not gonna go into a recounting of all the problems and the resource issues within hospitals around the country, both in good times and in bad. But this, what this map shows is what this solution is designed to address. The areas with the counties with the dark coloring have hospitals with ICU beds. The areas with kind of the orangey coloring have hospitals, but don't have ICU beds. And then the other areas in the gray really have no hospitals. And the point of this is that there's for the sickest patients in critical situations, frequently the strategy is, and as an emergency physician, I know this, the strategy is transfer the patient to a nearby hospital. Well, nearby in a good day, maybe a couple of hundred miles away, but in with the lack of surge, that could somehow overcome by individual transport, either by ground or by air. But in a mass casualty situation, COVID or otherwise, demand frequently outstrips supply. And it's sort of, as we talk about it from a disaster standpoint, we talk about space and stuff and staff. And space is an issue that many of you have had to deal with, and stuff related to PPE and other things is an issue many of you have had to deal with. From a staffing standpoint, there's live on the ground staffing, and then there's telemedicine staffing. Many of you have worked within telemedicine frameworks for many years now in all sorts of areas, particularly in the primary care and acute and space, but this is now a part of the landscape in the acute care space. This system is designed to bring critical care expertise to the bedside. And if you take nothing else from this, you can remember the sort of catchphrase that our friends at Tatrick came up with, critical care anywhere. Next slide. This is a complicated drawing, and I'm not going to go over every element of it, but you kind of think of putting together a tiered staffing model to include expertise from a nursing, a physician, and other caregiver standpoint to support bedside providers, both within hospitals and within other sites of cares like gymnasiums, large containment areas, think of the Javits Center or something like that, rural ICUs, although this is not just a rural problem. Bringing the expertise to the bedside and in an ideal situation through easy to use technologies that involve simple devices, not a lot of build out, and rapidly able to turn this on. And that's where Netson came from. Next slide. So as one thinks through this, and this really credit goes to our colleagues at Tatrick and Society of Critical Care Medicine for several years ago coming up with this general idea. What they were trying to design and what they ultimately have designed is all of these capabilities, secure mobile communications, capable of synchronous and asynchronous messaging. And I'm not gonna read every one of these, but you need a documentation platform. Everybody has a different EMR and one needs a way to document care. One needs an easy way to register patients into a system. One needs tools for managing handoff and managing communications. It needs to be HIPAA compliant, of course, and it needs to support a staffing model that then provides expertise to the bedside, wherever that might happen. And all those capabilities together are what has become Netson. Next slide, please. So if you think through the various methods, you can then take the map and then try to provide support levels for expertise around the map where critical care capability either doesn't exist or exists and needs surge support, either for 24-hour a day staffing or for off-hour staffing in places that may only have one intensivist. Now, a number of the initial use cases of Netson, essentially what has happened with Netson is now transitioning from phase one to phase two. I'll talk a little bit about what those phases are, but Netson has been operational now since late last spring or early in the summer. Through phase one. It essentially started with a competitive bid process that involved 72 teams that bid on the opportunity to join in the Netson program funded by Tatrick and DoD funding, working through a funding mechanism they had to bring together teams of technology and clinical support into a format that would then do through a research and development method, provide operations to hospitals. Netson has operated in Guam, in Puerto Rico, and throughout the Upper Plain states, the Dakotas, Minnesota, Iowa, to provide care to multiple patients in those sites. There are a number of stories of good outcomes. In Guam, a patient with a critical illness with a tension pneumothorax, diagnosed by a remote Netson provider in San Diego to allow for a good outcome while the only intensivist in that hospital was dealing with a cardiac arrest in another part of the hospital. A hospital in Minnesota that lost communications, although the hospital was then able to relay communications to a Netson provider through the existing cellular network to provide the care they needed. So many of these things happen through phase one. Next slide. So how has ASPR gotten involved? And this really speaks to how we're now talking with you as part of the HPP program. Early on in the year, this is, an idea that incubated over a number of years. Early in last year, DOD was able to put together initial funding to do phase one of NetSent. And that ultimately resulted in, after a several down selection process, four teams that provided care in the places that I mentioned before. Dr. Bob Cadlick, who was the prior assistant secretary in ASPR, felt very strongly that this kind of model, both for critical care and then, as one can imagine, as you're thinking through this, other specialties, whether it be infectious disease or pediatric specialties or others, could work across the similar theoretical platform and a real platform to provide care. And so ASPR and TATRIC in last September signed an MOA that brought with it funding to the tune of $45 million that is now funding phase two, which is being contracted essentially as we speak. And phase two, I'm going to go into a little bit about what this is, but this phase two integrates the teams. Instead of having four separate teams, begins to integrate them across the platforms, scale the delivery, integrate and beginning to do the research and development process to bring wearables and remote control devices in. Really sort of designing the next phase of telemedicine and disaster preparedness. ASPR has been very happy to be part of this, led by a large team that I'm only a support part of. And Joe Lamano, who many of you know, has been very integral in this in working with the TATRIC team. Next slide. So where do we stand now? As I said, there's a big military component, and so the primary information is available at this URL, tatric.org/netsen. If you Google TATRIC and NetSen, it brings you up to this. This capability is available to you to anywhere in the country now. There are some barriers to this, and I'll go over those in the next slide, or the next couple of slides. But essentially, this capability through the existing teams is able to be used now to provide response support. You can go to this site, put in a request, and reach a TATRIC support person. And these teams are capable both with technology and with providers to provide service to hospitals anywhere around the country. It works very simply across any device, phone, tablet, or otherwise. Does not require a great deal of infrastructure. Does require that any hospital that participates, one, have a need, although not necessarily an overwhelming need, but a need for intensivists, for ICU nurses, respiratory therapists to provide expertise. Obviously, the first question is, who's going to do the procedures? We can the team can certainly help with expertise on how to do that. That's obviously a requirement, but that's a requirement in any telemedicine system. This provides a number of things, and you see there under our services, relief coverage, expertise, technology, and communication, all to provide for surge support, which is useful in COVID, but as you think through hurricane season or earthquakes or other disasters, this kind of service being useful for hospitals to provide this. It is currently federally funded. It is fairly funded. And so there's really no cost to this. And it's something that the TATRIC team in collaboration with ASPR is happy to work through. Next slide. Now, many of you are probably in the middle of your own telemedicine programs, whether they be steady state things with primary care, with stroke care, with behavioral health, with critical care, otherwise. And there's been an explosion of this driven by a number of things over the past year, including a remarkable number of CMS waivers related to payment. That was the first barrier that went away. And then a number of other things, including licensing and otherwise. But some of these are really only partial solutions in the long term. And so we're considering these and figuring out how to manage this in what will be the post-COVID environment at some point. Whether it's state-to-state variations from a regulatory standpoint, reimbursement, interoperability and coordination among platforms and providers, all of these things are important. And there are many issues to be managed within ASPR and within the federal government and then within state governments about how service is provided across state lines. You're all familiar with NDMS that works across in a very specific way. And in fact, NetSyn could support NDMS teams remotely to provide expertise to them and perhaps reduce the need for some deployments if what's really needed is expertise on the ground. Many of these are policy issues that need to be worked through over time and will be worked through over time. Some of these things are aspirational that need to be managed. But one of the big ones, the licensing and the funding for this and the reimbursement for these services are things that people are considering now. And if you think through what various professional societies like the American Telemedicine Association and then provider societies, and then even the private sector groups that are working through telemedicine issues now, these are things that are being worked through. And all of you, many of you on this call probably have great expertise in this area and thoughts on this. Next slide. So I do want to make a few points as I close and hopefully leave a few minutes for questions. This is an existing program now. It is capable of providing services to hospitals on the ground now, has done so, as I said, in Guam and Puerto Rico and in a number of the Upper Plain states. When you go to the NetSyn site through TATRIC, you will see the current providers. As I said, the phase two contracts are being awarded literally as we speak. And what phase two will do is first take those operational elements and deploy them to new sites and new hospitals. And then a real key for this is to take those teams and build into those teams a network capability and improved capabilities for technology, such as remote control and better information exchange to really build what we hope will be the telemedicine system to support disaster preparedness ready for the future. And within ASPR and other organizations, we've certainly had discussions about how can we use current technology and future technologies to improve disaster performance. That's another talk for another day. But as you think through NetSyn, it's really more than just NetSyn. It's not just critical care. The same technologies are available for infectious diseases, for burn care, for pediatric specialties. One can envision scenarios where all those things may be needed, and technology certainly can speed up response and improve response and improve the scale of response to really modernize disaster care and use what we're capable of. DoD has been an important partner of this. One can also imagine the support for the warfighter all around the world. And DoD will remain an important R&D partner of this, but this is obviously an important function for ASPR and something that the ASPR team has been working very hard on. So I'm gonna stop there. I kind of flew through a lot of NetSyn, but I'm happy to take questions either now or offline.
Thank you, Till. And we will now open it up for any questions on the presentation. I do have one question in the chat right now. It reads, is there a vision for NetKin to support DMAT team response or a similar federal response?
The short answer is yes. The slightly longer answer is one of the important use cases for NetSyn is to support deployed teams. As you might, deployed teams tend to deploy with generals. They're very good and they're very skilled at managing difficult cases in austere environments, but they tend to deploy with generalists. And so as one might imagine, if a DMAT is deployed to an area where, for instance, there's the need for COVID critical care response and they don't have a lot of intensivists, or a need for a pediatric critical care support, or the need for infectious disease support, having this system available that provides for rapid communications into theater, for lack of a better term, to support a remote team would eliminate the need to try to move those assets to that deployed team when you really only need their expertise. So yes, that's certainly part of the planning and the vision. And the follow-up question, I'll go ahead and read that, is that would it include a state medical response team system? Absolutely, yes. This is not restricted to support of a federal team, a state, any team that needs the support can certainly access the support. So regardless of the source of that team.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions on Till's presentation, you can select the raise hand icon from the participants button in the bottom toolbar, or you can write your question in the chat. We do have another question. It says, where there are no ICU beds or critical care clinicians, there's typically little to no broadband and sometimes no reliable cell service. Is there support for connectivity?
Well, it's an interesting question and a good question. You know, connectivity and broadband are big issues for telemedicine around the country. That is true. There are places where there is little to no broadband and sometimes no reliable cell service. This does require a cellular network to deploy, although it could also conceivably operate across a remote or temporary cellular network, which occasionally get deployed to places. I mean, the communications companies have the capability of bringing in networks or satellite communications to support this, and that's really all it requires. So the connectivity support's not directly built into this program, but certainly coordinate with other connectivity support that was required in a location.
Thanks, Till.
I do want to add parenthetically to that question. We do focus on areas, you know, we talk about areas with no ICU beds or critical care clinicians. There are a number of areas with limited ICU beds, or even where an ICU that one hospital might think is an ICU, another one wouldn't necessarily would consider that more of a general bed. And so this is not all envisioned to go to even just rural areas. There are other hospitals that aren't too far from urban areas that may have limited capacity and can quickly be overwhelmed.
Thank you, Till, and thank you to everyone who asked questions. I'm going to go ahead and pass it over to Sonia Bell for her presentation.
Thank you very much and good afternoon, everybody. I'm Sonia Bell. I'm based here at Emory in Atlanta, but also one of the program directors for MeTech. And then before we go into the Guide My PPE app, I thought I'd actually take this opportunity to give everyone some updates on some projects that MeTech is currently working on as well. Next slide, please. So just a reminder that MeTech does provide free education training resources. All of these are available if you just go to our main website, meetech.org. All education and training resources are free. They are tailored for different healthcare worker groups and public health workers. And most to many of them provide free continuing education credits. We provide CNE, CME routinely, and then also a lot of credits for lab and paramedics and other healthcare workers as well. Coming this summer, 2021 and into fall of 2021, we are deploying a new curriculum with 70 individual modules, up to 10 hours of content. And all this will be organized into four key user groups so that we can meet learners where they are at. These will be organized into broadly the ones that are listed here, infection prevention, frontline care, pathogen awareness, and emergency management. And the content within these learner modules, they will span the breadth of what MeTech has typically done, from infection prevention and control and PPE to special pathogen awareness, like as it says there, waste management, and all of those domains that MeTech typically covers. We also have additional resources and more coming soon resources. They're all available again at meetech.org. We'll be deploying a podcast here soon and also some MeTech live sessions. We do still have our webinars. We have a webinar tomorrow at 1 Eastern time, overcoming challenges to supporting your workforce. And then we also have over 1,400 online resources in our expertly curated resource library, again, all online and available for free. Next slide, please. We also have free expert consultations and technical assistance available still. As many of you are aware or have participated before, we have done in-person site visits, but with COVID, we have focused with the virtual readiness consultations in order to prepare hospitals and organizations for special pathogen events. We also can provide technical consultations for targeted and focused areas that require assistance. And as we went into the summer and fall of 2020, looking at our data and some of our respondents' questionnaires, 74% of facilities reported that their previous interactions with NETEC and the readiness consultation process helped their facility with preparedness and or their response efforts to COVID-19. And again, please feel free to email us at info@netech.org to ask any questions or request assistance, and we'll get right back to you. Or you can also go to netech.org/contact us for more information. Next slide, please. And lastly, our big initiative right now as well is the National Special Pathogen System of Care. As written here, the mission for the NSPS is to provide a coordinated and standardized healthcare network to care for patients infected by or suspected to have been infected by a special pathogen such as COVID-19 in the U.S. The NSPS vision is to save lives through a sustained, standardized special pathogen system of care that enables healthcare personnel and administrators to provide agile and high-quality care across the care continuum. Right now, we're in a bit of a stakeholder discovery phase where we have 70 stakeholders and more than 20 organizations nationwide engaged through this development process that we're in. More to come this summer. There'll be further updates. We do have a website that just has kind of some splash material on there at nsps.org. And also, if you go to netech.org or follow us on any of our social media handles at Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook, we are providing updates there as well. So please continue to check those sites for more updates, or feel free to contact us or email us if you have any questions. And with that, I will actually go into the Guide My PPE app demo, if you want me to share my screen. All right, so this is the landing page for the Guide My PPE app. You can find this at netech.org, or if you just go to ppeguide.org. And you can see that we did develop this with COVID-19 in mind. So this is based on COVID-19 PPE principles. We are working on a phase two of this, which will add some more tweaks to some glove usage. We're also looking at capper and papper, putting some more of those other PPE use cases in this. So when you go to ppeguide.org, you just go to launch Guide My PPE, take you to a separate tab. And here's where you can either have help choosing your PPE, or you can select your own PPE. And just to make it easy on myself, I'll go ahead and select it. We have some disclaimers here, just kind of saying, like, you know, what best practices, also that this is dependent upon your own facility's uses and products, but go ahead and try to get it as close as you can. I will choose, I'm using this to care for multiple patients, as if I'm in a unit, with an N95 disposable gown. You can choose your own type of eye protection, and of course, gloves. And then when you hit next, you can choose if you want donning or doffing. And then when you actually go into the donning and or doffing, you can see that you can still toggle at the top here to go in between either one. It goes down the process here. This is also very mobile friendly, so it works well on iPads or phones. And if you don't want to do this electronically, you can also go to print. And when you print, it will get you, like, typically we try to keep these to about 2 pages so they're easy to post. And they're very, like, generic. There's no, we do have, of course, NETEC's name on here, but no other institutional icons or anything there. So it's very, you can kind of tweak it for your own institution. And then you can easily toggle to doffing as well and also print those. And then you can, and if you need help choosing your PPE, this also coaches you to going through whether you are or not providing care for a COVID patient. And then this gives you CDC's recommended minimum PPE guidance. And then again, you can go through what your scenario is. we are going to be adding also a scenario since there is less of a PPE shortage situation. kind of making that one of the options as well, and also kind of tweaking some of the glove options here. And that is the Guide My PPE app. I will stop sharing unless anyone has any extra questions or anything they'd like me to click through for further information.
Thank you, Sonia. As a reminder, anybody who has any questions, feel free to write those in the chat or to raise your hand using the bottom toolbar. All right, well, seeing none in the chat at this time, but we may have some time at the end after all presentations are finished to answer any questions that you all may have. And with that, I will hand it over to Matt Watson.
Great, thank you so much for that. My name is Matt Watson. I am a senior advisor for ASPR's National Healthcare Preparedness Program. And I'm here today to give you a quick overview of a project that we've undertaken looking at the development of regional healthcare emergency preparedness and response guidelines. To put the bottom line up front, building upon its lessons from current regional programs such as RDHRS, as well as the recent experience responding to the COVID-19 pandemic, ASPR is writing guidelines for regional healthcare emergency preparedness and response systems. Next slide. So given the outstanding work done by the RDHRS demonstration sites over the years, as well as what we've learned from other regional programs across ASPR, the government, and industry, we believe we are well positioned to begin development of guidelines for regional healthcare and response, regional healthcare emergency preparedness and response systems. These guidelines are required by Congress as a result of PAPIA's amendment to the Public Health Service Act that was undertaken in 2019. In that amendment, Section 319C-3 requires ASPR to develop regional healthcare emergency preparedness and response system guidelines. The purpose of the guidelines is to share practices and protocols for regional systems of hospital, healthcare facilities, and other public and private sector entities to increase medical surge capacity for public health emergencies. The guidelines are intended to cover all hazards preparedness and response. They will also include guidance for a public health emergency resulting from chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear agents, as well as emerging infectious diseases. The practices and protocols included in the guidelines will provide information as it relates to five major buckets of information. First, providing a regional approach to identifying hospital and healthcare facilities based on varying capabilities and capacity within a region. Second, the guidelines will include practices and protocols with respect to physical and technological infrastructure, lab capacity, staffing, blood supply, and other supply chain needs. Third, another large component of the guidelines will include protocols to protect the healthcare workforce. Fourth, the guidelines will include protocols for disease containment, medical triage coordination, and patient transport. And then lastly, the guidelines will include considerations for the needs of at-risk individuals and children. As the guidelines are developed, we will be engaging a variety of stakeholders to ensure that all perspectives are considered, and we'll be talking about that more later in this presentation. Notably as well, ASPR will consider policy and financial implications related to the content just mentioned. Specifically, as the guidelines are developed, we will consider feedback relating to financial implications for all stakeholders engaged in regional preparedness and response. The guidelines will also include potential incentives for entities to engage in regional preparedness and response efforts. And it is our hope that these guidelines will be used to complement the healthcare preparedness and response capabilities that ASPR has already established. Next slide. So through research and robust stakeholder engagement, ASPR has observed several emerging promising practices for regional models. We'd like to touch on these themes because they will be important inputs to the guidelines as we move forward. One theme we've seen emerge is that regional programs that actively expand partnerships across public and private sectors are typically better able to tailor their response to the specific needs of their communities. Building upon existing relationships and inviting new partners ensures that healthcare preparedness and response stakeholders can leverage all the resources, innovation, and knowledge at their disposal while also supporting at-risk populations during an emergency response. Additionally, regional models have successfully increased statewide and regional medical surge capacity through the development of tiered systems. For example, the success of ASPR's four-tiered system of care developed for the regional treatment network for Ebola and other special pathogens can be attributed to the inclusion of regional and state treatment centers, assessment hospitals, and frontline healthcare facilities. Successful regional models also support patient movement and load balancing through coordinated patient transport from states with limited healthcare capacity. From ASPR's experience with the medical operations coordination cells, as well as the National Disaster Medical System, we have demonstrated ways that tools can be used to support a regional approach to patient load balancing. Additionally, the use of data and technology has transformed healthcare preparedness and response, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. It will be critical to continue prioritizing the collection, use, and synthesis of those data to ensure that healthcare stakeholders across the region have access to accurate and timely information. Another trend we've seen emerge is the importance of setting clear delegations of authority. In order to gain common understanding of the bigger picture, it's critical to identify roles and maintain clear lines of authority and decision-making within individual healthcare organizations and facilities. We also acknowledge that every community in every region is unique and that regional systems should identify and consider a variety of elements, such as climate and demographics, when developing a regional community profile. Community knowledge leads to better, more targeted planning and response. Our research also indicates that regional programs should ensure adequate training is available to all hospitals, their staff, and first responders, including online educational offerings to better handle emergency situations. And programs that integrate specialized medical teams into their workforce further a regional system's response capabilities to specialized threats, such as CBRN threats and pediatric casualty management. Lastly, COVID-19 has highlighted the value of innovative care options during disasters. Regional coordination should involve leveraging tools such as telemedicine, mobile care, and in-home care to provide coverage across the region. Next slide. So a regional approach to healthcare preparedness and response cannot be developed in a vacuum. Given the many regional footprints across ASPR, we want to use feedback from everybody to make sure that we get it right. This graphic provides an overview of the stakeholders we plan to consult and engage with as the guidelines are developed, but should also note that this list is non-exhaustive. We acknowledge an important consideration to the guidelines is ensuring that the entire spectrum of healthcare delivery is included in the approach, given that the COVID-19 has shown us how important it is for healthcare readiness stakeholders to be included in preparedness and planning. Next slide. And finally, we welcome your feedback as we move forward in this process. now leave some time to answer any questions that you may have and look forward to those. Thank you very much. I do see one question here in terms of the timeline for engagement. It's a great question. We will be starting that process shortly and anticipate it continuing into the summer. So much more to come. Thanks, John.
We also have another question in the chat that says, what are ASPR's plan for disseminating and using the guidelines once they are completed, and will they be used in a mandatory manner?
You know, Rosalind, I think that's a really good and important question. I don't anticipate that they will be in any sense mandatory, but more to come on how this develops.
Do have another question in the chat, which reads, with such a limited sample of pilot programs, are you also looking at data from established coalitions that have many of the points you are looking at?
Certainly, the coalitions are critical to the process from beginning to end. We will definitely be reaching out and trying to learn as much as we can from all of your experiences. Absolutely.
So it looks like we have a few minutes before the top of the hour. So I'd like to open the line for any questions, either for the presenters or for ASPR in general. Again, feel free to write your question in the chat or raise your hand.
Jennifer, John Wilgus. I know you mentioned camp being opened up on June 1 for end of year. Am I correct in assuming when will data need to be entered in by? What's the closing date for camp?
Yes, good afternoon, John. You know, I anticipated that question, so I'm glad you asked. So the close date for the submission of the data for the end of year report will be July 30.
Very good, thank you. And my follow-up question, are you anticipating, is ASPR anticipating an alignment of the fiscal year reporting to kind of get on track with HPP so that the quarters align so that it, I know it's a different fiscal year, but are you anticipating that the reporting will kind of align so that it's more mid-year is more in the middle of the fiscal year and the end of year is more closer to the end of May? I know you were delayed this time around.
we are anticipating to get get that cycle back on schedule. So with the mid-year, you know, typically that would be, you know, about 3 months after the midpoint, which was the October timeframe. Okay. And then for the end of year as well, for us to be able to get those back on schedule.
Very good.
Yeah, we experienced some delays this year due to the kind of delayed opening of camp.
Right.
But
right.
Good questions. Thank you.
You know, we did have a couple of questions that we had kind of anticipated with respect to the regional guidelines. Maybe just in this next couple of minutes, I could walk through a couple of those in case others on the phone may have had those and didn't want to articulate them. So the first is really, why is ASPR and particularly NHPP leading the development of regional guidelines? I think, you know, clearly, as the only source of federal funding for healthcare preparedness and response, NHPP manages and administers a variety of healthcare preparedness and response programs that have become increasingly focused on regionalization over the years. NHPP has unique perspective and reach across public health and healthcare, and the branch serves as ASPR's source of expertise for healthcare readiness in many ways. Additionally, this requirement is part of section 319C-3, as I mentioned earlier, which is tied to RDHRS, which is also administered by NHPP and ASPR. Sort of another question could be, is this the same as RDHRS? The answer there is that the regional guidelines will leverage lessons learned from ASPR's regional programs, such as RDHRS, but they are intended to be more broadly capture regional healthcare emergency preparedness from a higher altitude perspective. It's important to mention that the term regional with regard to these guidelines is a reflection of more than just state and local jurisdictional boundaries or HHS and federal regions. Instead, we're thinking about regional as a true movement of people and resources across the healthcare delivery systems and spectrum. When will the guidelines be shared for input? We are working toward engagement with stakeholders for input from May through July of this year. How can we give input on the guidelines? You know, we look forward to your feedback when we share an interim version of the guidelines shortly here in May of this year. You can also share any immediate feedback by emailing hpp@hhs.gov. When will the guidelines be posted? The answer to that is we hope to have them publicly posted for use in August of this year. And finally, will any funded be provided in order to implement these guidelines? Certainly we acknowledge that additional resources will be needed to implement the guidelines, and we will have more information about funding mechanisms that could be used to implement them at a later date. So let me just stop there and see if that stimulated any thought or comment.
Matt, John Wolgus in Florida, I have to ask, as you get down into that outer band of partners that you had on your graph there, who's going to lead those conversations? Is ASPR or your FPO is going to come into to each state and kind of work not only with state partners, but then, you know, down in different regions or with the locals? Or do you envision a lead agency or a lead convener?
It's a really good question. Maybe I'll just say I anticipate probably a range of approaches. I think we're going to look for, you know, good opportunities where the community has already convened in order to get some of that feedback. In terms of the regional outreach, I could certainly see a role for the FPOs, but I'm not sure we will be doing it, from a nationwide perspective. We may have to pick and choose a little bit. Jennifer, do you have any other kind of comment or perspective on that?
No, I think, Matt, what you've laid out is the right approach. You know, initially when we are preparing, when we will be preparing to receive that feedback, we're going to be looking at it kind of a broad reach, leveraging kind of what we would say meetings of opportunity, those meetings that are already existing that we may be able to leverage. So for example, you know, the National Healthcare Preparedness, the National Healthcare Coalition Preparedness Conference, so leveraging those meetings. Also, you know, John, you know, meetings that that the Hospital Association, the American Hospital Association may be convening, as well as these meetings here. You know, of course, we didn't have a whole lot of time today. We wanted to just kind of introduce what was upcoming related to the regional guidelines. So we're looking at a number of vehicles and a number of media and venues in order to kind of gather that input and feedback, and also to ensure, you know, as Matt's last slide showed, with all of the various stakeholders, to be able to engage folks appropriately at all levels.
Yeah, it makes sense. Thank you both. Appreciate that.
Thanks, Matt, for going over those additional questions. I will now hand it over to Jennifer for closing remarks.
Great. Thanks, Zoe. You know, of course, we want to thank all of you for the work that you do every single day and for taking time out of your very busy schedules to join these monthly calls. And, you know, it is our goal to provide you with content that may not be necessarily specific to the execution or carrying out your cooperative agreements, but is definitely important information as you continue to do the important work that you do, as well as those subrecipients that you provide, provide funding support, that we are hopefully providing you and your subrecipients with tools and resources that you that you'll find very, very useful. But as we build out the agenda for these calls on a monthly basis, as well as the all recipient calls, you know, please feel free to provide us that feedback regarding agenda items or topics that you may want us to cover during these meetings. And you can send those, of course, to our resource mailbox, hpp@hhs.gov. With that being said, I wanted to thank our presenters for taking time out of their schedules today. And again, for all of you, for all of your active participation in today's meeting. As always, we would love to hear about how you and your hospitals and other related healthcare entities are using the cooperative agreement funding to make an impact on the communities, especially as it relates to the current COVID-19 response. To submit your story, either email the hpp@hhs.gov mailbox or fill out our new story from the field submission form, which is available on the Healthcare Readiness in Action Stories from the Field website. And our team will insert the link directly into the chat for easy reference. And then following that submission, a member of our communication team will reach out to learn more from you. So again, thanks everyone for joining us today, and have a great day. Thank you.